Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The sharper-eared listener will have no problem whatsoever this week spotting that, at the time of recording, I was just coming out of the back of a fairly decent cold that was playing merry havoc with my vocal cords. I mention this purely by way of a preemptive defence of what could be the most poorly chosen simile of my career to date. So you can enjoy that. I like to fondly imagine it was because of the painkillers. Alternatively, it might be the shape of things to come. Anyway, we're talking music today in the East End of London, and I'm fairly certain it would be easy enough to craft a weekend drinking game around this podcast and the uses in it of the words baroque and offer. I'll leave that to those people of legal age and responsible disposition. Incidentally, if you fancy finding out what my favourite day in London would consist of, my favourite London building and other must-know facts, head over to cabbyblog.com, where typing my name into the near-invisible search box on the right-hand side of the page will produce the London Grill, which the writer of that blog, David, who's a licensed black taxi driver, has put together. For now, though, it's the 30th of May 2014. I am N. Quentin Wolfe. This is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey, baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sound. You ain't never seen the light before, just a stone's throw from your front door.
Hello, it's a moderately sunny day today here near Spitalfields, and the buildings consequently are like ovens, a combination of the computers churning out heat, and the heat rising to the top of the building, which is where you find me now, in a sort of a converted garret of some description. We're looking down onto Brushfield Street. Across the way we can see the old London Fruit and Wool Exchange. With me, the CEO of Spitalfields Music, Abigail Pogsonhigh.
Hi.
What are we up here to talk about?
I think we're here to talk about Spitalfields Music and everything that it does. And the most immediate thing that it's going to do is make a summer festival, which starts in, well, at the time of speaking, a month. I think that when you're listening to this, you might be hearing it about a week before we start on Friday the 6th of June.
Friday the 6th of June, and it's a big old festival, and I sort of find myself circulating around this area a fair bit and was surprised and a little bit ashamed to discover that it's been going on for 40 years and it's crept under my radar, so I'm going to correct that and hopefully correct that for anybody who's as yet unfamiliar with the festival. What's the scope of the thing?
Well, as you said, the charity itself was started almost 40 years ago as a summer festival, which happens in June. It's continued over that period, and since the summer festival started, other things have kind of added to what the charity does. So we now also run a winter festival, which happens in the middle of December each year, and a really big year-round learning and participation programme, which works with people of all ages, mainly further east in Barking and Dagenham and Newham. So the reach of what Spitalfields Music does is quite broad. But as I say, the most immediate thing on the horizon is the Summer Festival, which is the biggest of the two, and is a mix of amazing music made in lots of different Spitalfields spaces. So from the really iconic Hawksmoor Church at the end of Brushfield Street, where we're sitting now, through to Village Underground, Wilton's Music Hall, some of the front rooms around Spitalfield, some of the old weaver's houses. So a whole range of spaces. And one of the joys of programming the summer festival in particular with that range of venues is that the music and the space can align, and you can make something that just wouldn't happen in any other part of London.
Now, trying to let myself off the hook, I'm wondering if that's maybe why I hadn't encountered it or hadn't knowingly encountered it, because what I imagined when I heard Spitalfields Festival was that three streets in any direction from the market here would be closed down, there'd be bunting all over the place, and everything would be happening in white. But it sounds as though it's decentralised. And what about these different venues? How does the character of each work with the music? I mean, I know Wilton's reasonably well, for example. What's going on there?
Yeah, the music that we programme is really eclectic, and that's because we take inspiration from the venue, so we make sure that the work that we're programming really suits where it's going to be performed. So as you can imagine, in somewhere like Christchurch, which is 300 years old this year, the first stone was laid by Nicholas Hawksmoor. It took them a while to get it built, but they started in 1714. That really suits Baroque music and music from that period. Acoustically, it's absolutely brilliant for that kind of thing.
Oh, what's the detail there? Why so?
Why acoustically does it suit it? It's just the shape of the building, the nature of the stone, the kind of textures in the building just really support that kind of soft but broad sound that early music will make. So it's really great for example, this summer we've got the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment as associate artists. It's really great for the programmes that they've put together. But the part of the reasons why we're in lots and lots of different spaces is that different people want to hear different music, and one of the kind of key things about our work is that we're trying to offer music to as many people as possible. So a counterpoint to the OAE as associates is brilliant young clarinetist Aaron Ghosh, who is doing a series for us also as an associate artist, and I think he will attract quite a different crowd of people.
I sort of want to unpack some of the musical styles there. It took me a long while to find out what early music was. I didn't really know what sort of instruments I might be expecting to hear there or what style of music it might be. So maybe we could come back and unpack some of that stuff as well. Organisationally, this sounds like you are taking on professionally the sort of thing that if we were talking about one venue running a sequence of music and different performers across the length of time that we're talking about here, that would be quite a handful. But you're effectively running a whole bunch of different festivals under an umbrella all at once. You're clearly crazy.
Yes.
Why the hell would you do that, Jess?
It's certainly not the easiest way to do that. But as I say, the driving thing is that it means that you are open and making an offer to a wide range of people. My experience of people coming to concerts or events is that they put a really strong attachment to the venue and the location where something is happening. And some venues just, I think, feel more comfortable for some people than for others. And that's a really strong motivation for us as a charity. The whole point of the thing starting nearly 40 years ago was it was actually twofold. It was firstly, it's very hard to imagine now, but Spitalfields was outside of things. It was really off the mainstream. It was somewhere that taxis wouldn't go down Brick Lane. It was kind of out of central London.
Even 40 years ago?
Even 40 years ago. There's a kind of urban myth that when the first festivals happened, for those that were coming from other parts of London, there was a bus from Bishopsgate down to the end of, down Brushfield Street, which is a very short distance to Christchurch, to kind of show people where to go. I think that's a myth, but it's certainly something that kind of lingers in the air. And the whole point of starting a music festival in this area was in saying there's a whole population of London here that should have access to brilliant music. Let's make it possible. And that happened to align with the fact that Christchurch has an amazing acoustic for a particular kind of music. So it really, it really made sense to make concerts in it at the very beginning.
Now, this is reminding me very much of the sort of ethos, although it's getting on for 100 years later, that seems to have been behind the founding of the Bishopsgate Institute, which, of course, is just up at the end of, give or take, at the end of Rushfield Street. But I'm kind of surprised to hear that that same sort of thinking was going on as recently as 40 years ago. So that kind of Victorian philanthropy that we find ourselves talking about very often on this show. What was the lingering spirit all about there? Because now we're talking sort of post-Second World War, 70s, 80s. What was that spirit doing here then? And we don't seem to hear too much about it in that period.
Yeah, I suppose that's right, because that was the period when a lot of the architecture of the area was under severe threat. You know, there were kind of plans to really kind of knock down some buildings that now we look at and think, gosh, that's absolutely extraordinary. For example, piece of Georgian architecture that, you know, been very carefully restored. And for me, in all honesty, I don't know why it came together at that particular moment. But for me, it's an example of how the arts and artists can really sort of point to something and help communities, individuals, cities even, look at things in a different way. And certainly that thing of looking at Christchurch in a different way, thinking about, well, we could put music in there, and drawing people into the area, celebrating the area as something where positive and exciting things happened, rather than thinking about it as somewhere that was other. And that then moved to the whole restoration of the market and the kind of renaissance of the area. It's, you know, very strongly connected with that. And that whole move in this area has been led by artists. You know, you see that in lots of places, in cities and beyond. And I think that's one of the amazing things about the arts and artists, that they can just focus something in a way that other things can't quite often.
That's very interesting. We were talking to composer James Hesford about 6 months ago and thinking about Islington, and he was saying very much the same thing, that it was musicians who were, well, essentially responsible for the house prices shooting up because they brought cultural capital into the area and pushed it. So, I mean, Spitalfields music is why we can't afford flats around here. that's what we're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're saying, of course.
Was the festival and Spitalfields music, did they appear at the same time, or was the festival done by volunteers for a little bit, or how did it work?
Yeah, that's right. It started as Spitalfields Festival, and we became Spitalfields Music about 5 years ago, when the charity looked at what it was doing and realised, well, firstly, we've got two festivals, we're not just one, and secondly, the depth and the range of the year-round learning and participation programme was such that we wanted to really acknowledge that in the name, and the fact that we're a year-round operation as a charity, and that is as fundamental to what we do as the two festivals are as well.
So I suppose I'm trying to understand the model of the reason for existing, because it seems like it doesn't have a focal point, or like there's an anxiety about it just having one purpose. It seems to want to be diffuse.
Well, I suppose it's got a single charitable purpose, which is to change lives and aspirations through music. That's our kind of our big hairy goal, if you like. And therefore the festivals and the projects that we run on a year-round basis are ways in which we aim to do that. And the thing that we're aiming to do is to reach as many people as we can within East London with all of that activity.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, so the sort of cultural change that we've touched on that's happened over the last however long, you know, it's no longer the case that the East End in its entirety is a deprived area. I wouldn't presume to say to what extent the media class have change that landscape, but presumably when at the outset that charitable purpose could quite easily be aligned comfortably with the entire East End. Are there challenges now in making sure that you are helping the aspirations of those who are perhaps less privileged, or is it equally spread across everybody who happens to live in the area? How do you manage that balance?
Different activity reach different people, and that's one of the beauties of having a range of activity. I think, you know, there is this popular myth that the area has gentrified, but we know from other parts of London that the picture is always very mixed and
ever-changing.
And ever-changing, and that's particularly the case in this part of town. One of the particular characteristics of this part of London is the growth of the young population. So the youth population in East London is growing at a faster rate than in other parts of the, in any other part of the UK. And one of the things that we do is we try to find ways to make sure that all young people have access to music, that it's that it's offered in a very even-handed way, and that it's not about what your background is or what kind of opportunities you might get through your own family, but that we can reach a really wide cross-section of the population, which there is within Tower Hamlets. And as I said, we're starting over the last couple of years we've been doing more and more work in Barking and Newham, and different profile but still the same kind of thing.
Well, there's two directions I want to go in at once here. One is about that age issue that you mentioned. Perhaps we could start there, but it also might be useful because we've spoken in the past a little bit about the sort of Brick Lane area and that cosmopolitan mix of ethnicities and all sorts of different people around here. People might be less familiar with what's going on in Newham more generally, Barking, so perhaps we could visit those areas and sort of describe those. But what about this youth thing? When you say youth, are you thinking in terms of young people coming here to work, or are we talking sort of a birth surge and younger people coming up that way?
It is a mix, but at its base is just a birth. You know, there are more people being born here and growing up here than there are in other parts of the UK. But there is also, there is an inclination to move to this part of town, in part because, you know, in certain parts rents are cheaper and all of that kind of thing. It's, you know, it's a good place to live as well as a young person.
I don't know if this is about to be an indelicate question, but why so many young... I mean, I know why so many young people, I know how that happens, but I mean, why is this part of town experiencing that surge?
That I don't know. It's probably density of population and the profile of the population and traditions within those populations, but I don't know for sure.
You might be thinking of bigger families or something like that?
Yeah, precisely, Yeah, and that's interesting for us because, I mean, we've always, as a charity, focused on young people, and this year the charity was one of the first arts organisations to form what we refer to as kind of education programmes. So this year marks 25 years of our Learning and Participation programme. And recently we started to think, for example, about how we can make concerts for the very young. So we've been working with a couple of really brilliant artists to make a series of music theatre pieces for 0 to 2 year olds using Baroque repertoire and using players. For example, this summer it will involve players from the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, singers from the 16, for example, and these are musicians who are touring internationally. They're of the highest quality, and one of the things that's really fundamental for us is that the quality must be high, whatever the context, whoever it's being offered to. Everybody has the right to hear brilliant music, brilliantly played. And so the series is called Musical Rumpus. It's about 40 minutes worth of music, and we take an existing piece and take real music from it, adapt it for a slightly smaller ensemble, and shape it so that there's a story which 0 to 2s can engage with. It's made in a way which means that they can get up and walk around, they can touch it as well as see it and listen to it, so they don't have to sit on their adult's lap. And this is...
And they can sort of reach, touch the instruments?
That's right. So they can move around and touch the instruments, they can touch the set, they can touch the singers. There's a lot which is built into the show which involves their participation. So things to shake or things to build or things to put somewhere. And it's built on, you know, I'm getting very geeky now. It's built on early years practice, so on what we know about how young people learn. But it's also at a very basic level an opportunity for that age group to hear live instruments, live singers up close, the very best. And what we found in using Baroque repertoire is that because the instruments often sound quite soft, it's particularly suited to that age group. It's a very pleasing sound.
Right, as opposed to a bit of Karl Orff or Wagner or something.
Or a drum kit in the corner, you know, yeah. A modern drum kit in the corner, for example.
That is absolutely wonderful. We know, don't we, that the neural pathways are all being formed in those early years. So what are you hoping that you're engendering an appreciation of music in the most general sense, or is there a different aim?
Well, I guess at its most fundamental, we're hoping to contribute to the development of the people that come along, you know, to contribute to that kind of cognitive and social development. We know that exposure to music and to these kind of activities really helps that. And we also know that certain parts of the population might have more access to that than others. So we're taking that work through East London, placing it in libraries, children's centres, spaces that people trust, and therefore reaching people who may otherwise not have access to that kind of thing. At another level, I guess what you're hoping is that children and their families might enjoy it as an experience and might build a habit of coming to the arts and engaging with music and live performance and be curious about it and want to find out more.
You're flying the flag for the arts as well. I laughed when you started talking about this. I laughed because you talked about participation and I really thought you were suggesting that you were getting 0 to 2 year olds playing Baroque music. So how could that possibly work? The obvious follow-on question would be about the reception of this, and I would be a fool to think as CEO that you wouldn't say, well, actually it's pretty good, because you wouldn't be doing what you're doing if it wasn't being well received. So if I take that as a given, and maybe we could return to that in more detail, but do you find any negative reaction, any hostility or resistance to this sort of general idea?
Not particularly, but of course with anything like this, there's always the option not to engage with it. You know, we're not forcing people to engage with it. So if people aren't interested in it, then they can choose not to come to it. The thing that's been most interesting recently is where the partners that we've been working on it with have started to use these performances as a centre point for other activity. So to show families that are coming to the centre for this performance other opportunities, and to signpost to other activity that they could get involved in, to put in place opportunities for parents to get involved in actually running the shows so that they can build skills and count them towards qualifications. So for me, the interesting thing about this kind of activity is how can we contribute to London and London life in a really broad sense?
Well, that brings us very nicely to the subject we touched on a second ago, which is those other areas nearby and the sort of profile. I guess if there's one reason that Barking has crossed my radar, I don't think I've ever been to Barking, but it's crossed my radar in the news in terms of the politics there, which in, let's say, the last 10 years, probably going back before then as well, of course, have been split along race issue lines every now and again. So maybe we could look at what Barking is and how you're working there, but also a picture of the racial diversity of the area more generally and how that plays into what you're doing.
It's really mixed, and the thing that characterises all of the three boroughs that we are working in at the moment is the pace of change, both of the population and also their physical environment. We've talked about Spitalfields where things started and the physical change here, but it's still going on. There's, you know, huge development around Aldgate and a huge development up by Shoreditch High Street. So it's kind of constant pace of change, and that plays through. I mean, you know, Newham most obviously, most famously through the Olympics and all of that development has, you know, changed physically. And our role as a charity is to celebrate what's there and to create positive things, and also to create opportunities for people to connect with their local area and to through music and through the arts to explore what community and what place are and whatever that means right now. And who knows what that really means right now. You know, you asked me to describe what's happening in embarking. That's, you know, who knows in lots of ways, who could possibly say. But the thing that we're doing is, and I think the thing that the arts do amazingly is that they create opportunities for people to reflect on what they see or feel or are engaged with at a particular time, at a particular moment, and connect that with where they are and you know, the context that they're in.
There's a certain vagueness about some of that, and necessarily so. I see why that's there. I suppose there's something sort of lingering in my mind that, well, you're saying that you don't know what's embarking, it's a little bit intangible. At the same time, there must be at least a suspicion or an awareness, or call it what you will, that in general there are less opportunities there. There is more of a need for the thing that you're offering, which might be more readily available to somebody in a better off, more privileged part of town, for example. I'm wondering, when you think about getting people to engage with the area that they're in, what sort of results that throws up if the area is, you know, in some ways troubled, whatever that might mean?
I think every area has positives, and it's about creating opportunities for people to explore those positives or explore what's ahead of them. It's not about making calls on, you know, there's good stuff happening here, there isn't good stuff happening there. It's about people exploring what their context is. And I think the amazing thing about London, and particularly this part of town, is that that's a very, very complex thing. You know, you walk around a corner, you can be in a completely different world in London.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not suggesting that there are binaries within any area, nor that there are some areas that are kind of good and some areas that are bad or anything like that. I'm more sort of wondering whether, with a lot of community work and a lot of outreach aspects of different projects, there is the focus on what makes this area special kind of thing. But isn't there also a legitimate use for art to explore things that are troubling, for example? I don't necessarily want to just focus on the negatives, but maybe there's something slightly artificial about only focusing on positives that can be found.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, art and its capacity to allow us to look at things that are difficult or challenging is unrivaled, to my view. So yes, of course, and that's great. I suppose what I'm not saying is that, you know, our view is not that, you know, if you bring art in, it'll all be all right. It's about making an offer and being part of a wider community, being part of a mix. So, for example, working in partnership with the Royal London Hospital and Vital Arts to run projects, and being part of, basically being a part of the Tower Hamlets community. But yeah, absolutely, the arts are great for looking at difficult questions and challenging situations.
So part of this is you're seeking to give people an additional vocabulary?
Yeah, the arts in the broadest sense, and music quite specifically, allow people to, I mean, some people describe it as a chance to step back, some people describe it as a different language, different ways of looking at it, but it this kind of engagement can take you into a different realm.
Well, we'll be coming back in just a moment. We're going to get a word from our fine sponsors at Audible, who are offering words in audiobook form. I'll be back in just a moment with Abigail Pogson.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfe, with me Abigail Pogson, the CEO of Spitalfields Music, which is all year round and spreading like an omelette. But what a weird metaphor. I suddenly realised there were no good spreading things that were going to reflect well on Spitalfields Music. Shall I take that? Let's not bother taking that again. It's just too...
I don't think I've ever heard it described as an omelette before.
You can have that one on me. What can we say about the history of Spitalfields? How far back does your knowledge extend?
I've been knocking around for about 5 years.
I don't believe it's the rule with history that you're only allowed to know as far back as
what you've been around for. Well, the thing that people refer to first and foremost about Spitalfields is as an area of arrival and departure, and one of the kind of key things about the area, both in terms of its vibe and its communities and physically, I suppose, as well, is that you can see those cycles of people arriving, living here, making it theirs, some of them moving on, some of them staying, and so that you've got a situation where now, you know, there are over 100 first languages spoken in the space of you know, 4 square miles. I suppose the other thing that people often associate is the Georgian period, because at the front door of the area, which is to say where we're sitting now, the market and then Commercial Road, there are some pretty iconic examples of that architecture that, I mentioned 5 years. It still does slightly take my breath away when I approach the area from Liverpool Street and walk round the corner, and you see that the spire is still, it still sort of knocks me out a bit. But there's a lot more beyond that. You mentioned earlier on the kind of Victorian period and Bishopsgate and Toynbee Hall and Oxford House, and there's a whole kind of movement and development. And what I find really interesting is the those layers and how they're represented both architecturally, but also in the, as you move through the borough, the different kind of parts of the borough and the different communities that are there.
And we know it's called Spitalfields because it used to be Fields until scarily recently, in fact. And I think I'm right in saying that Henry the one of these facts is going to be wrong, but I think it was Henry who used to use the area for firing cannon and testing them out or something like that. And then of course when we think about Bishopsgate, we know that was one of the gates into the walled city of London. So we're outside the city here, I guess.
Yes, yeah, we are. And well, Spittle comes from hospital, and so when the area was recently developed, there were various points of pause as sets of bones were found, and kind of burial sites. And I think that it was very much where you chucked the stuff that you didn't need. The city put what it didn't need, and that actually included people in lots of ways.
Well, that's right, because anywhere with ditch after its name, Houndsditch and Shoreditch, and I think I'm missing one, where exactly that?
That's right, yes. My top London tip for exploring this kind of history is the Museum of London. They've got, it's amazing to look at their maps across years and to look at the kind of the evolution and the shape of the city and how it's moved. If you look at London globally, how it's swung west and now swinging back east. And there was, for a very long time, a very clear mark down Bishopsgate of, and it was as simple as in and out.
That's very interesting. I really never imagined that, despite having in the last couple of weeks recorded episodes where we're in the east of town and looking at all the development going on there, a lot of housing appearing, a lot of the housing that's already there really relatively new in comparison with a lot of other stuff in London. So do you think the centre of London is moving ever towards the east?
I think that it is moving back eastwards at the moment.
Coming home.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that means you're going to be in the centre of London very, very soon.
We will. I mean, I think that around here on a Saturday night, it's like Soho in lots of ways.
We can't go a step further. You've mentioned that you arrived here 5-6 years. Are you a Londoner? What was your path into both the role and this part of town?
My vowels probably betray me. I'm from the north originally, so I'm, yeah. But I've lived in London for my working life and really love it as a city. And therefore, and I'd always worked in music. In fact, I started out in opera, but I'd always worked in music and was really, really interested in this role and this charity, because Firstly, because it's in a part of town that I really love, and I love the fact that it's a very strongly local charity, as well as, you know, it's got a national profile. People come to it from other parts of town. You know, proportion of our audience are tourists and visitors to London, but there is a very strong sense within the festival programming, as well as the year-round program, of connection with the area. And it goes back to, you know, where we started, which is that the program is made in part in response to the venues and the spaces that are available, and celebrating, you know, both the history and the future of the area. I've talked quite a bit about early music, but we also commission a lot of music and make work that's having its first performances, and that's a really important part of this part of town. You know, there's always a sense of kind of the new and the fresh, and that's what inspires that programming, that, you know, making new work is really important.
Programming, what level of freedom do you have when it comes to setting the program, maybe commissioning something, maybe following your own tastes? Of course, it's going to be tempered by the requirements of what you're aiming to achieve, but how much latitude do you get?
Well, I think in a way it's a blank sheet of paper, and I think that the opportunities are there in what artists want to make and how they want to engage with the platform that we've got in the festivals, and the area and the approach that we take. So what we commission comes out of conversations with artists.
Can you flesh that out a little bit? I'm trying to imagine how that happens. It sounds very organic. How does that happen? What's the meeting point between the two? Do you sort of bring people in and organise a conversation to figure something out, or is it sort of chance encounters and your time spent in the business? And how does it work?
It's a mixture, I suppose. It is reasonably organic, and it's often, you know, you can't quite see when something is going to form into this actually is a commission, this is a new piece of music that we're going to schedule and we're going to happen. So it's often about an ongoing dialogue, and there's a bunch of us in the team who hear a lot of work, meet artists, are engaged with what's going on and what kind of work people are making. So it's a mixture of that and saying, okay, how about it, what do you want to do, what are your ideas?
So a lot of this must depend on artists wanting to be part of this process, because you surely couldn't be doing this without not just the interest, but really achieving momentum through adding the momentum of the artists themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And fortunately, a lot are. But also it's possible to, I think, you know, through the process of a conversation, figure out whether it is the right match or not, whether we should be working together or not. And that's, you know, that's part of what the process is.
We'll say something about precisely whose momentum you are harnessing in just a second. Okay, so of course I'm going to put you on the spot and ask the question you shouldn't ask here. What's your favourite act in this? No. But what do you like, if you had to pick two or three acts out, or performances out of the offering in this summer's festival, and I know it's going to be difficult because there's lots of good things to say about all of these, what sort of things might you highlight for quality? I don't know, them being the first time they've performed, or something that's not being done elsewhere, or what would you highlight?
Well, there are two collaborations between composers and visual artists that I think are going to be really interesting. I think they're going to be really interesting. They're brand.
You're not biased in any way.
I'm not biased in any way at all. They're brand new, so I don't know for sure, but I've got a strong hunch that it's going to be really brilliant work. So one is a collaboration between James Weeks, composer, and Sam Belinfante, visual artist, and their piece is being made at Lime Wharf. It's a new piece called Mural, which the audience will sit in the middle of and be surrounded by the sound and the visuals. And then very, very different, but the same kind of collaboration, composer Bryn Harrison and visual artist Tim Head are making a piece for Rich Mix, which, again, I haven't seen because it's a commission, it's a brand new piece, but I'm really excited by the conversations that I've heard between all of those artists as they're building work together. So that's one set of work that I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, can I jump on those? How, when you're commissioning a piece of work, to what extent do you set out a menu of the sort of things that you'd like it to do, or do they come to you with half an idea and you say yes, that's it, or is it a completely blank canvas and you just trust them? Where does it lie?
It really varies. It completely varies. The conversations are all different. So sometimes an artist might come and say, I would really like to make this for Wilton's Music Hall, for example. I've got this vision for it, and I've come to you because I know that it's the kind of thing that you're programming and that you're working with. And it's the kind of thing that audiences come to you for. Or right at the other end of the spectrum, there might be somebody whose work we've seen or encountered or thought that's interesting, and we might initiate a conversation in a very kind of general sense of what are you thinking next, what's on the horizon, and then a piece of work might evolve through that kind of conversation. We might start to suggest venues, we might suggest collaborators, we might suggest themes or topics. So it really does vary hugely, and that's in part about the way an artist works, because that's there is no single every individual works differently, and artists come at their work in lots and lots of different ways. So for us, as I'm getting very 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 nerdy now, for us as producers, it's about responding to that and picking up on that.
Well, yeah, that kind of nerdy knowledge that you're talking about, it does seem that's really very important. You've got to genuinely understand the trajectory or the period in the artistic sense that this particular artist is in, surely. You've got to kind of know roughly where they're coming from and where they're likely to go with a piece if it's a new commission.
I think there has to be a willingness to connect with that and to understand it and to support an artist. There's no point pulling in an opposite direction if it's not the right moment.
And what else would you highlight from this year's Summer Festival?
Well, if you're... So something completely different at the other end of the spectrum. There's some absolutely brilliant Baroque music. It's sort of headlined by the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, who I've already mentioned.
Now, I'm getting the impression there's a lot of Baroque music going on here.
Yeah, I think that there's a balance of Baroque and contemporary music. Those are two things that, if you were just talking about two things in terms of the programming, that's what you would point to. For example, the 16, the English Concert, who are really well established practitioners, musicians in this area. And then we've got the debut in our festival of a younger ensemble who are working with early repertoire called Fieri Ensemble. It's a group of young singers just emerging onto the scene, making really, really interesting music. So if you're interested to try something historic, there's a lot there as well.
Just to nail this down in my mind, I guess classical music isn't a strong suit. I've got a bit of an idea. But how would you define Baroque music, given that it makes up such a portion of the content? What makes Baroque music Baroque music?
It's music that was written out of a very particular spirit, which we now, with the benefit of hindsight, connect with its time and what was happening in terms of who was on the throne, what the cultural influences were at the time, what was going on in the kind of broader cultural life of the nation. It's a it's a European phenomenon, and that was part of it. That the kind of cross fertilization was an interesting thing. I think the other thing, obviously I've talked a bit about the connection with this area and kind of, this area saw its most iconic building made in, in that period. But also in the UK, over the last, certainly last 20, 25 years, there's been a renewed interest in this period, and particularly in this period's music, and a real revival of orchestras and choirs that perform this music on period instruments, so the kind of instruments that would have been used at the time that this music was new, at the time that the equivalents to Bryn Harrison and James Weeks, who I've just talked about, were actually writing the dots on the page. It was 1714, and when Christchurch was being built, and it was the Hanover, the Georges, and as I say, there was a kind of very strong connection with Germany and with the kind of Middle Europe at that time. And, you know, Handel is a really kind of central example of a composer that links Germany and Britain. You know, we think of him as a Londoner, but, you know, I think in lots of ways one might think of him as German as well.
That always has a Handel, I always think of a very triumphal sound.
Yeah.
What is the spirit that infuses Baroque music then? What, if you could you pin it down, or is it not possible?
I think you can't. I think, you know, it's really broad in the sense that, you know, if you said to anybody now, how would you characterise music that's been written in 2014? It, you know, you could talk about a particular thing, but you wouldn't be able to describe it as a whole. Obviously, historically, certain things fall by the wayside and certain things rise to the top. And there's an interesting thing to look at what does rise to the top and what gets performed far less. And, you know, a lot of material gets lost. But I suppose if you were to stereotype, you might say that there's a joyousness to it. And that, like I was saying, culturally there was... it captured a kind of spirit and a sort of sense of optimism and kind of renewal and looking outwards. And I think if you want to hear that, you can hear it in a lot of music from that period.
Mm. Well, I understand now, having said that, why the space would need to be just right to you know, to keep the reverb going and allow the space for those sounds to be felt as well as heard. Well, we're edging towards the end of our allotted time. One other highlight, if you will, and then we'll give the website where people can find out about all of this stuff, because as your listener have detected, there's a huge menu to work through here and one easy gateway for all of that. What's your final pick?
Final pick is Final Day, Saturday, 21st of June. Something completely different. Crowd Out. It's a piece written by an American composer called David Lang. He was inspired when he went to watch Arsenal play a decade ago and was listening to the crowd chanting and making what he heard as music together. And it's taken him a decade to write this piece. It's for 1,000 untrained voices, so people like you and I, and can participate. It's 40 minutes long. It's being performed in Birmingham, Berlin, London and New York over the space of a few months. Our performance is on the 21st of June. It's going to happen around Arnold Circus on the bandstand on the Boundary Estate, which is, again, completely different era from some of the periods that we've been talking about, but again, architecturally and physically a really interesting part of Tower Hamlets.
And a very good example of that urban renewal that we've been talking about earlier on.
Yeah. Fantastic. I mean, the first of its kind, that is the first social housing, and you know, it's still standing. So this piece for 1,000 people to perform is called Crowd Out, and it's about, I suppose it's inspired by the idea, how do I feel when I'm in a crowd? How do I feel when I'm standing? I know that I'm me, I'm individual, but I'm within a crowd, and it explores that. And I have heard parts of the piece, and I think it's going to be an absolutely extraordinary event and well worth catching up with if you can.
Well, only one question remaining then. How do we catch up with all of this?
Spitalfieldsmusic.org.uk or 0207 377 1362.
Real life phone numbers, nobody does that anymore.
Apparently some people do.
Wow.
And we're very friendly here. Give us a call.
Reminder that the summer festival run by Spitalfields Music, the 6th to the 21st of June this year, so get your skates on. I dare say tickets by the time this goes out will already be flying off the ship. Tickets don't go on a shelf. They'll be flying out of whatever tickets are contained in. A rubbish ending to the podcast. Abigail Pogson, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yes.
They landed on a high there.
Yeah, I think we did well.
I should just assume you'll edit those things out.
Do you? My heart aches for some far off place. No one cut it. And that's that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Abigail Pugson. Thanks too to Mark Barr and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea in a Baroque style. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.